during these last few days, amongst the various themes that Ajahn Taniya and I have been exploring, and things that have come up in the conversations, interviews, the subject or the teaching on anatta, not self, is one of those regular features, or one of those aspects of the teaching that comes up, being a very unique and specific teaching in the Buddhist tradition, and something very powerful and liberating. But it's also come up in conversation. How do the teachings on not self, you know, that we are reciting every day with like the morning chanting, body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, etc. How does that teaching relate to the quality of self-esteem, or does it?
Yeah.
If there's no, if the body and the mind are not self, then does that relate to a positive self-esteem, or a negative self-esteem, or no self-esteem, or what? Running out of steam? No steam. So so I thought I might reflect on that a little bit this evening, just to begin with that, how that fits in with the Buddhist practice or Buddhist teaching, because it's curious, you know, because obviously the Buddha was trying to teach human beings, people, devas, to have to find a way of life that brings happiness. Like the we recite this discourse on the highest blessings. It's, you know, all these different ways that we can establish, you know, happiness and peace in our lives. All these, you know, good influences, and so it's obvious the Buddha was teaching, aiming towards that. So it's curious, how does that work? How does that fit together with our sort of cultural conditioning, or the idea of, you know, a positive self-image, or a healthy sense of self-esteem? Well, the Buddha's approach, what you find in Buddhist teachings, Buddhist psychology, is it's interesting the way that it works. So, based on qualities, primary qualities such as dana and sila, generosity and virtue. You know, this is the foundation of happiness, or a the foundation of contentment and spiritual practice. These very simple qualities, dana and sila, and the way the Buddha outlined it in a number of teachings. He said, when you establish your life on generosity, and then particularly on virtue, on sila. So there's, for one who practices sila, one who is restrained with regards to conduct and speech, there's no need to think, may my heart be free from remorse, because it's natural. For one who practices restraint in terms of body and speech, for the heart to be free from remorse. Something of a no-brainer. If you don't do things that are regrettable, you don't have to regret them. Very, very basic form of psychotherapy. If you want to be free from, and maybe those of you who are therapists or psychiatrists think, "Pah, this is hyper-simplistic." And maybe it is, but there's also something to be said. It's kind of behavior therapy. If I don't tell lies, or I don't hurt other beings, or I don't harm others or deceive others or abuse others, I don't have to remember having done that. And so the Buddha points to this is a major way that we can provide the basis of happiness or contentment, because the heart is free from remorse simply because of not having to remember having done harmful or abusive or deceitful, cruel, indulgent things. And then, as he said, those for one whose heart is free from remorse, there's no need to think, you know, may I experience delight, pamoja, may I experience the quality of cheerfulness, if you like, a kind of inner brightness, because it's for one whose heart is free from remorse, it's totally natural for them to experience that quality of brightness, of delight, pamoja. And then for one who experiences delight, there's no need for them to think, may my body be relaxed, because it's totally natural for one who experiences delight for them to be physically relaxed, kaya samati, for the body to be at ease. And that's the intrinsic natural result. You know, if there's that kind of cheerfulness and brightness, then the body relaxes. And this is for one whose body is relaxed, there's no need for them to think, may I feel joyful, may I feel at ease, piti and sukha, may I feel content. Because one who is physically relaxed, one who has that kind of, those kind of qualities of ease and physical freedom from tension, like we're not all uptight, then it's natural to feel joy, natural to feel sukha, contentment. Oftentimes when I'm giving instruction about how to work with the mind, some of you have touched on in conversations already during this week, you know, when the mind gets very taken up with anxieties, with worries, you know, the fretful syndrome, the mind just busy churning away like a little hamster on its wheel, spinning away, forever turning, never getting anywhere, worry, 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 worry. But one of the ways of working with an anxious mind, a fretful mind, is to notice how much the body contributes to that. You know, and one of the encouragements I like to give is that when you notice that your mind is getting worried about something, anything at all, no matter how sort of subtle or coarse, if you, instead of focusing on the thing that you're worried about, being late for an appointment, being late for the sitting, worrying about whether you're going to get a slice of pie or have taken too many slices of pie or whether you should have another slice of pie, after all, mustn't let it go to waste, but I'm being greedy, but it'll go to waste. fretting away, rather than letting the attention go onto the pie, bring the attention into the body, and then notice where do you feel that anxiety. And different people feel that in different ways and in different styles and patterns, but oftentimes we feel that sense of anxiety, a knot of tension in the solar plexus, so down in the belly. There's a kind of tightness. At least that's where I tend to find it for myself. So for years I used to do this as a practice, because I could be quite a fretter. You might not believe that, but I used to have a really pronounced fretful tendency. So Venerable Karuna Dhamma now has claimed the right, I think he's about to retire soon, he's becoming very mellow in his old age, but he has been a resident fretter at Abhayagiri for some time and came up with the motto, it's my jitter and I'll fret if I want to. Those of us of a certain age will not recognize the the reference. Anyway, getting back to my theme, I would do is every time I saw my mind getting uptight or upset about something, I'd deliberately let go of the particular object, or bring the attention away from that and into the body. And every time, I find a sort of tightness in my gut. So I train myself just to physically relax, just to let my body soften, let the stomach relax. And this was something I learned from Ajahn Sumedho, who was very, very good at teaching this. And as he pointed out, developed, it's almost impossible to keep a good worry going if your belly isn't tight. If your stomach is relaxed, if your belly is relaxed, you can't keep a good fret going. It just won't work. You need the physical backup. And you can try. You can try this at home, or try this right now if you like. If you tighten your belly right now, instantly a nameless worry arises. You know, we feel anxious, even though there's no thing to be anxious about. And then relax it. Instantly, and if you haven't got a tight stomach, if your belly isn't tight, it's really hard to stay worried, even if there's a really good reason to be worried. You know, I'm sure Ajahn Amaro can read my mind. He knows it's my personal problem. Even if your belly's not tight, you can't get really stirred up about it. It's just, oh well, so he knows what's going on in my mind. So what? Well, I don't. But, you know. Even if I did, it wouldn't be a problem. So the Buddha was onto this 2,500 years ago, and he pointed out, you know, when the body is relaxed, if you haven't got a tight stomach, if you practice what I call the abs of jello. there's a famous exercise video here called Abs of Steel. So this is the counterpoint to abs of steel is abs of and jello is their word for jelly, right? Yeah, they mean jelly when they say jello, right? Abs of jello. Just, you know, let it flop. Shamelessly brimming over your belt. Popping out of your shirt buttons. Just let it spread. No points for abs of steel on this retreat. So then it's hard to stay worried when you just let it all hang out. So that contentment, you know, is when the body is relaxed, when there's an ease, and not just the stomach, also the shoulders or your jaw and the kind of face, you know, the body's relaxed, and the basis for tension and like a mental stress is withdrawn, as the causes for that, which is backing it up or supporting it, is withdrawn. So it's much easier just to stay at ease. And then the Buddha pointed out, for one who is at ease, when there's piti and sukha, joyfulness, rapture, when there's contentment, sukha, then there's no need for one who is experiencing sukha to wish, may my mind be concentrated, because it's totally natural for one whose mind is at ease for the attention to concentrate, for the mind to concentrate. It's like if you're happy being here at the Angelus Center, you're not. If you're content here, if you feel at home here, you like being with these people in this place in this time, then the mind doesn't think about, oh, I wish I was, you know, down in town watching a movie, or I wish I was back with my dog, or I wish I was off in Alaska, or back in Mexico, or. You know, if you're happy here, the mind doesn't think about Alaska or Mexico or Egypt or, you know, the movie theater, because you're happy here. So it's a very simple kind of equation. Again, it's something of a no-brainer. But If we are content here, then the causes for making the mind want to go and be somewhere else are not there. So that what makes the mind agitated is, I don't like this, I want something else. I want a past or a future or something different about this. But if this is, if we're fine with this, then the causes for wanting to things to be different or to be somewhere else are not there. So that the mind, without those, the causes for discontent, the mind rests easily in the present moment. Concentration arises naturally. And similarly, when the Buddha said, if for one whose mind is concentrated, there's no need for them to think, may knowledge and vision of the way things are arise. Because it's totally natural for one whose mind is concentrated for them to know, to see the way things are, for knowledge and vision of the way things are, yatha bhutang jnana dasanam, for that to arise. It's a kind of intrinsic result. So it's like when you pay attention to the present moment, then our innate intelligence and pattern recognizing qualities function. We recognize, you know, how things fit together. There's a kind of an awareness, a natural attunement, a recognition of how things work. And they said, for one who has knowledge and vision of the way things are, when that insight arises in, particularly into anicca, dukkha, anatta, then there's no need to think. May the heart become dispassionate and detached, because when you see everything as impermanent and not self, then the heart relaxes, lets go, because you can't own it anyway, so why bother trying to? it can't stay still, it can't be permanent and solid, then there's no need to try and grab it. It's just cloud, it's smoke, it's insubstantial. So who can own a cloud? Who can own a thought? Who can own a wisp of smoke? It's not ownable, it's not solid, not substantial. So the heart doesn't try to chase or to own or possess or keep or push away. And then he said, for one whose heart is dispassionate and detached, there's no need for them to think. May the heart be liberated. He says, when it's totally natural for when there is dispassion and detachment, when the heart lets go, for the realization of freedom to be apparent. That's the natural result when the heart lets go, when it's not entangling itself with something, some condition that's born and dying, then the unborn, undying, the deathless is apparent. That's the kind of intrinsic and innate result. He said it's just like, you know, rain falling on the mountains, that, you know, forms into, yeah, the rain falls on the mountain and forms into the little streams, and the little streams join together and form into the larger streams, and larger streams form together and flow into pools, and the pools overflow and form into the bigger streams, and the bigger streams flow together and form the rivers, and the rivers flow together and form the great rivers and flow to the sea. No one has to decide that. You don't have to have a committee meeting for the streams to think, well, shall we join together or shall we not? Do we have consensus on this? There the rain falls and then the water does its thing. You know, the streams form and the pools gather and they overflow, and the streams flow together and down they go to the sea. It's the natural cascade, the effect of water and gravity in the hillside. It just does that. There's no need for the water to think, shall I flow downhill? Shall I form into a pool? Shall I form into a stream? It just does it on its own. So in this way, sort of backtracking a little bit, we can see that you have these a whole cascade of wholesome states, starting out with generosity and virtue, dana and sila, and then just based on those simple qualities, leading to delight, to physical ease, to contentment. And then, based on that, you know, on those simple psychological, you know, wholesome psychological qualities, then that leads to concentration, to insight, to liberation. So you'll notice, the astute observer will notice that there's no particular sense of I or me or mine involved in all of that. So what we would, when we're feeling those qualities, you know, maybe if your body's relaxed, you're feeling delight, you're feeling contentment, you're feeling joyful, then on one level, say from culturally, we'd say, I feel good about myself. How are you? I'm happy. We would call that a positive self, you could call that a positive self-image, or feeling good about yourself. And so we would use a self kind of language as a convention or as a form. But actually, when we look, there's within each of those qualities, whether it's delight, whether it's contentment, whether it's physical relaxation, there's no sense of I or me or mine intrinsically woven into any of that. There's joyfulness, or there's contentment, there's delight, there's ease, but there doesn't have to be an I or a me or a mine who is the owner or the holder, the knower of any of that. So this is a way of understanding how what we would think of in sort of Western psychological terms as a positive self-image, you know, feeling good about ourselves or high self-esteem, how that can be established, and the causes for that, and then sort of for that to be developed into an abiding of attitudinal quality, you know, like an ongoing sense of how we kind of quote feel about ourselves, unquote. Those bright, radiant and pure, noble qualities can be established, but without any kind of concrete, separate sense of I being added onto it. And you'll probably have noticed during the course of this last week, yes, it has been nearly a week we've been together, but when the I and me and my feeling kind of steps in and adds itself on, that actually starts to clog up the pamoja and the sukha, the kind of delight and contentment and ease tends to get a little bit more turgid and cloudy and difficult when it's mine. when I'm the owner, the doer, the actor, the feeler, I am the creator, then it all gets a little bit more sort of heavy and clouded and turgid. At least that's what it feels like here. Well, that happens in my mind. It's also important to recognize that just it's not like illegal to use the word I in Buddhist psychology or Buddhist thinking, or that to think it's something wrong in term if one's using terms like positive self-image or high self-esteem. You know, the Buddha was really clear. These are just common usages. And when someone said to him, how can you possibly use personal pronouns when you talk to people, and yet you proclaim this teaching about not self? How does that work, Venerable Sir? You know, surely you're negating your own teaching. You know, if you say that all dhammas are not self, body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, how come you use like language like you and he and she and we and they? You know, surely that goes counter to your own teaching. And even in the sutta, you can always hear the Buddha sighing. Okay. But he says, yeah, well, for just out of the sake of the need to communicate, then I use personal pronouns like he and she and we and they and you. But they're used without confusion. They're used without any kind of delusion of being they're being sort of solid, separate, independent entities. But just for the sake of expression and communication, then those conventional forms are usable. So it's totally okay to use language like self, you know, high self-esteem or positive self-image. It's not like the kind of the Buddhist, you know, the Buddhist inner tyrants, you know, the kind of the Triple Gem Committee, who kind of wade in as soon as you think the word, I feel good about myself. Gotcha! Stop that! Shouldn't think that way, that's wrong. Wrong view, dung! The Triple Gem Police. The karma police come in and kind of cite you. Use of the concept self. You know, like getting marks on your driver's license. Three citations and that's it, you're benched. You know, we can use these forms, we can use these words, but the important thing is just to use them without delusion, without confusion. And so that we're aware that when we say I and you and me and I'm talking to you, that, yeah, we can use those conventions, but without confusion. It's like Ajahn Chah would often say, you know, if you misunderstand the teachings on anatta and you say, well, how, Lumpo, you talk about anatta all the time, but how come you function like ordinary people and you're using all these terms like he and she and we and you and they. He said, well, if you misunderstand anatta like that, it's like as if, you know, you say, well, there's no self, so no one we shouldn't use names. So like if you go to a crowd of people and you say, hey, person, because they're all, you know, rather than dwelling upon the names, is, well, who would know who to answer? You don't know who you're talking to. So to go out of convention, you say, oh, John, Susie, Jane, Harold. Because out of convention, that's how we get by in the world. And it's not a matter of never using concepts or structures or forms. You know, there is the body and there is the personality, but it's understanding how that fits together and seeing that these are conventions that we pick up and use. Also, in the same way, it can be, people can, along with self being taken as some sort of illegal thought or, you know, concept that we shouldn't use. Buddhists don't have a self today. Buddhists don't have a self. Well, it's not quite the way it is. It's like, similarly, people can say personality, you know, personality view. That's the first of the 10 fetters, sakkaya ditti. So therefore, I should get rid of my personality. So I've got to get rid of myself. Most Buddhists say, you know, all things are not self, so I've got to get rid of myself. And personality view, that's number one of the 10 fetters. So I shouldn't have a personality. All that stuff they taught you in high school about personality plus. No, personality minus. I have to wipe out my personality. If I'm going to transcend suffering, I have to wipe out my personality. Well, again, that's kind of misunderstanding. It's like trying to sort of not be a self or not have a self. It's sort of taking a concept and misunderstanding it. Because you'll notice if you spent any time around sort of great Buddhist teachers, most of them have, apart from the outside, they seem to have personality plus. They're usually more colourful characters than the average. So it's helpful to understand how those things fit together as well. How can it be that Sakkaya Ditti is, you know, that personality view is the first of the 10 fetters of the, you know, the 10 obstructions to enlightenment, you know, in order to realize stream entry, to enter the stream of Dhamma, to enter the first stage of enlightenment, then one has to be the transcending of personality view. How does that work with our life and our sort of characters and our, you know, the body and mind? So it's really very, very similar to what I was saying about just the feeling of self, is that we shouldn't be afraid to recognize, you know, personality as being just an ordinary structure in nature, just as like the feeling of I and mine. It's a useful thing in nature. You know, it's not as though the our evolutionary process went so sadly wrong and created the feeling of I. It's just that when it oversteps its boundaries, when the feeling of I goes from being just a convenient psychological structure to pick out, you know, an individual in a crowd, it's I and you, to being a sort of a permanent, independent, solid entity, then yeah, that's when it becomes a problem. So similarly with personality, it's interesting that the very English word personality comes from the Latin persona. Per means through, sona means sound, so it's that. And the persona is the Latin word for the mask that they use in the theatre. So it's that which the sound goes through. So a persona is your mask. So right there is the clue. You know, it's that's the clue that it's just a face that we meet the world with, and that it's just something that we put on. So that we shouldn't be afraid to use that. Just so like getting into your car, you know, you don't say I am a Toyota or I am a Nissan or I'm a Ford, I'm a Mercedes. Maybe you do. I'm a Mercedes. Actually, Mercedes was named after the inventor's daughter. It's his daughter's name. He named the car after it. But that's beside the point. The vehicle is just something that we climb into to go places. We don't identify with it. We don't sort of claim it as absolutely who and what we are. So in exactly the same way, to let go of personality view doesn't mean to say we're supposed to wipe out the personality or kind of erase that or kind of be a non-person, erase all individual characteristics. It's more like that's the mask that we talk through. That's the agency with which we function in the world. And so it's a matter of just knowing, understanding the personality and letting it do its thing without confusion that is absolutely who and what we are. So it's interesting. We have Ajahn Thani is from New Zealand, as you might have noticed. So kind of Kiwi characteristics, and then I was born in England, so yeah, English characteristics. The rest of the monastic team here are homegrown Americans. But we all talk through our own and function through our own particular cultural conditioning, our own accents. So even if you have an English accent or an American accent or a Kiwi accent or a sort of mixture of all of the above, it's just an accent, isn't it? It's just like the shape of your feet or the color of your eyes. You know, it's just a means, as the form. And that you can identify with it. Say, I am absolutely English, or I am absolutely Kiwi, or totally American, all American. Or we can see, well, it's just a form, it's just a structure, it's just a sound. It doesn't have any intrinsic fabric to it. It's just a patterning. Then we're able to function through that form, and that can, you know, exist as a way of relating to the world, but without any confusion. And it's it's interesting when you are around sort of great spiritual teachers, people who are very very highly accomplished. It's as I said, you know, the striking impression is often that they are far more colorful and strong characters. But there's also, at the same time, there's this strong sense of there being nobody there. It's like there's the person that, so you can see it, you can be with it, right, in the presence of that thing, you know, the personality happening and doing its thing. But, yeah, you know, absolutely, you know, no individual, no separate person there who is the doer. There was a friend of ours in England, George Sharp, who was one of the people who originally invited Ajahn Sumedho to stay in England back in the 70s. Years ago, he went to visit Ajahn Mahabua in Thailand, and Ajahn Mahabua is recognized as sort of being a great arahant and an incredibly skilled teacher. But he also has a slightly grumpy persona. He is notably crusty, grumpy. And George wasn't quite prepared for this when he went to Thailand. So here he was, a devoted English Buddhist, trekking all the way to the wilds of northeast Thailand to go and visit the great enlightened master. And then when he got there, and he was expecting, you know, some kind of gracious welcome or sort of some kind of polite conversation, and yeah, Ajahn Mahabhua was just very offhand and coarse with him, actually. And after a few days of this, George, being rather forthright kind of character, said, "Tanajan, can I ask you a question?" And this was through the translator, Ajahn Mahabhua. "I came all the way from England to study and practice with you, and I'm just amazed how rude you are." "Yeah, you're really impolite. And, you know, I sort of ask you some questions, and I'm sort of very sort of sincere and trying to behave appropriately and not make too many mistakes. But, you know, you're kind of rough and coarse, and you make fun of me, and you kind of criticize everything, and you're kind of offhand and churlish and basically rude. So I'm wondering about this." And as this was translated by Ajahn Paniwada to Ajahn Mahabhua, he just started laughing and said, "Well, that's just my personality, you know. You know, I that's just how I am, you know. Don't be fooled by that. You know. That's just the surface. Don't take it seriously. That's just the way I come across, is I'm a rough guy." "So see, I was a boxer before I was a monk. You know, I'm a rough guy, so it just that's the way it comes out." And it was clear to George that he wasn't just trying to excuse himself. It was just, "Oh, well, that's just the shape of my feet. That's just the sound of the voice. It's just the framework for it. There's nothing there. That's not the whole story." And George could see that was the fact, and he was, you know, his attention was being caught by the sort of rough treatment on the surface, but he could see that when Ajahn Mahabhua was underneath, was actually there was this tremendous spaciousness and extraordinary gentleness and purity, but his attention had been sidetracked by the sort of blunt, coarse, you know, kind of rough edge of the tongue. So when we see these teachings or reflect on these teachings about letting go of personality view, it's not a matter of trying not to be a person or to not be, you know, if you're extrovert, to not, you know, to try and sort of make yourself, you know, shut up and be quiet, or if you're an introvert, trying to sort of make yourself feel comfortable while you interact. It's more getting used to the way we are, to being true to your own heart in a way, true to your own intuition for the, you know, the right way to relate to any situation that we encounter, and the letting go is not a matter of sort of erasing the patterns or sort of if you know, wiping off the expression on the mask of the persona. You know, we all have our own particular karmic configurations. I was born in England, you know, and grew up in a particular kind of family, went to a particular kind of school, was born in a certain year, part of the country, so this is the pattern you get. Ajahn Thania is from down under, she's from New Zealand, so she was born in a particular time, a particular family, and so that's the pattern she gets. And then all of you, you know, we have our own conditioning, whether we're from Thailand or from, you know, born in the US or China or, you know, wherever it might be. We have the patterns of conditioning, and you don't have to feel like you've got to be different or you've got to mimic the teacher, or like, "I really admire Ajahn Thania, I want to be just like her, I'll develop a Kiwi accent." How do they say, she'll be right? That's not quite it. Practice in front of a mirror, you know. Or in the privacy of your own room. "If I should die, think only this of me." Doing Rupert Brooke impersonations in privacy of your own room. It's not a matter of mimicking those we admire, even though that can happen sort of on its own steam. It's being true to your own heart, being true to your own nature. Just cutting through Sakkaya Ditti, personality view, is just letting the personality happen. Just like, you know, you have a shoe of a certain size and eyes of a certain color and a certain accent to your voice. So just let that happen. Let that be the shape of it and the form of it. But by being true to your own heart, trusting your own intuition, just letting yourself respond to situations according to that intuition, according to mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, to mindfulness and wisdom, sati panya. So it's really trusting that capacity of the heart to attune itself to each moment and not feel like I've got to be somebody else in order to be right. The rightness doesn't come from fitting a particular pattern. The rightness just comes from that relaxing and letting go, mindfully attuning to the moment, to not trying to fit some kind of preconceived model of, well, a truly enlightened being would always be like this. They would never be like that. They would always be cheerful, or they would always be solemn. They would always be awesome. They would always be light. They would always be happy. They would always be serious. And then you kind of create this sort of fabricated model of a the Arahant, and then try and inhabit it. Turn into some sort of Disney-esque monster. Me trying to be the Arahant. It's like sort of driving from the back seat using chopsticks to steer the wheel with. Dangerous. Do not try this at home, let alone on the freeway. Yeah. It's just being at home in your own seat, and if it's time to steer, you steer. You know? So that, and it takes a lot to do that. It takes some resolve to and faith, really, to just do what you do and let the world make of it what it will. To not be trying to structure our lives and what we do and how we function by, you know, either our own model of what's right, or by the mysterious they, as in, what will they think? I want them to think well of me. And as I often say to people, I've never met them. The mysterious they who create opinions about everything that I do. I never met one. I met lots of individuals and kind of... But the mysterious them, you know, they who I'm trying to please all the time, so the sort of shadowy, imminent squeezes that are off in the distance, them, what will they think if I do this or if I'm like that? The secret is they don't, well, it's not a secret, the fact is that they don't really exist. There isn't a them. There's only us. And that, so it's a relaxation, letting ourselves be, letting the heart be at home in that attunement, that mindfulness, that heartfulness, with each moment, and trusting that response. So, letting go of personality view, or seeing through personality view, it's like letting go of that I am the body, I am the personality, as a sort of solid, permanent quality. But it's just letting the body do its thing. It's like with the walking meditation, letting the body walk, knowing the body, feeling the body walking. And there's a difference between that and me doing walking meditation, me practicing walking, I'm walking, capital W, me sitting, very capital S, yeah. No, it's just the body sitting, body walking. It does it on its own. You know, like the poem of great master Shu Yun that Ajahn Thanya was reciting. Yeah, the in the spring the flowers come on their own. They bloom by themselves. Like, you know, I hate to say it, but you can say this body is a flower. It's a leaf. It just does it on its own. You know, you don't have to stand over the persimmon tree and say, that leaf should now be budding and appearing, it should open. The tree doesn't need a director. It's like the streams, you know, and the rain falling on the mountain. You don't need a committee meeting to decide on the streams. The persimmon and leaves do it on their own, and our life does it on its own. Decisions happen on their own. If we trust in mindfulness and wisdom, wise choices get made, sensitive choices get made. The right thing gets said or not said. Yeah, moment by moment. So then personality view can be seen through. We can drop that obsession with I am the body, I am the personality, the Sakkaya Ditti can be dropped. But from the outside it still looks like, you know, we still look like a human being. We'll still pass for human. You know, they won't notice that you're not really a person. And in fact, you feel more at home in the world in a strange way, in a mysterious way. The more that Sakkaya Ditti is let go of and seen through, the more that the personality is not identified with, the more you find yourself at ease being a personality, being a person. Because there's something in the heart that recognizes this isn't really who and what I am. It's not a limitation. I don't have to defend this or protect it or have people think good things about it. People can make of it what they will. They can say, how beautiful, how ugly, how short, how tall, how right, how wrong. And you think, okay, fine. You can make of it whatever you like. And not because you're sort of dismissing people or saying, I don't care what you think. Pah! I'm fine. I don't care. It's not that. You know, you care, but you're not caught up. Our heart isn't entangled in the views that the world creates. So these are just some reflections, you know, as we're reaching this kind of in the middle regions of the retreat, and probably people are aware that a few more days, three or four more days, we'll be together, and those sort of murmurings of life beyond the Angela Center and the other world. How will I function in the other world? Well, one of the things that we can do while we're here, and that is these kind of insights that we can cultivate into being a not self, into letting go of personality view and conventions, you know. The more we develop these skills, the more we get the feeling, the sense for how this works, then in this environment where things are very contained and very, very steady and very supportive, the more we get the feeling for that, we really let that insight soak into our bones and let its implications really penetrate the heart, to permeate the heart. Then as the perceptions change and we have to sort of put on our persona, we kind of get our names back. You're not just sort of blob number 8 in row 3. Suddenly you're having to be professor or mom, dad, you know. You're like, you have to relate to your dog and your house and your job and the road and the children and decision making. But all of those things that we suddenly have to perform as a person, you know, it's very nice being blob number 3, row 8, or blob number 8, row 3. Very comforting. For the relief. I really enjoy it when I go to kind of countries or places where nobody knows me, or some kind of conference where you're just some kind of event and you're just nameless blob. It's a great delight. But then if we're then terrified of having to be a person, and someone says, oh, hello, I don't know, I don't know, I've been recognized, spotted, no, I'm not him. I just look like him, yeah. I'm somebody else, yeah. Then, you know, that's not cutting through personality view, that's just, you know, adopting a I can have an anti-personality. You know. It's not, you know, it's still Sakaya Ditti. It's just trying to reject personality or to not be. But the more that we really get a feeling for how this, how these insights work, what they are, we let ourselves really know the sort of transparency of the feeling of self, of I, the qualities of the personality, then we can put them on and we can be. You can be the professor, you can be dad, you can be mom, you can whatever your dog calls you. Your dog will be happy to greet you again, and you can be that. You can be mom, you can be dad, you can be the teacher, the professor, the helper, whatever you need to be. You can just sort of put on the mask and do the thing, and then when it's not necessary or appropriate, you can take the mask off again. You pick it up, do the part, take it off. Without any deception. It's not like we're sort of training ourselves to be, you know, good little hypocrites. I can't just pretend. It's not pretending. It's just responding, you know. When my sisters come to visit, my two sisters and brother-in-law came to visit in April. It's kind of amazing because they don't see Monk. They see my little brother. Even in the monastery, you know, all the clues are there. You know, it's not as though I'm going around with a wig and jeans on. You know, the clues are there. And there's pictures all over the place and Buddha images and that. It's like I'm the little brother. So to my sisters, I'm not Ajahn Amarok. To you guys, of course I am, because that's what's on the promotion. You know, they're on the poster. You know, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Taniya. So that's who I am. To the Christian fundamentalists, they see a robe like this. They go, servant of the Dark One. I'm not kidding. Yeah. You meet someone who's from Thailand or from Sri Lanka or Burma, and they go, "How delightful! What great good fortune! You're a noble one, a holy one. Well, are you a servant of the Dark One, or are you a holy one? You know, or are you a little brother? You know." Say, well, am I deceiving my sisters, you know, that I'm pretending to be a monk when I'm actually really their little brother? Am I deceiving their other monks when, you know, that I'm pretending to be a monk when I'm actually just, you know, that little boy from Kent, that, you know, that's who I really am, is the 8-year-old. Disguised with a 50-year-old body. Yeah, I'm actually 8-year-old Jim from Farthing Green Farm. Really? You know, and that's, you know, to my sisters, that's the fact. Yeah, really? You know, don't be fooled, you know, because that's who he really is. That's fine if they want to think I'm 8-year-old Jim from Farthing Green Farm, that's fine. They wanted to carry that around, that's their business. Just do what you do and let the world make of it what it will. If you want to see me as sort of exalted holy being, well, that's fine, that's your problem. You know, another mouth to feed. You know, when we all leave on Sunday and making our way down to the city, then to the others on the road, you know, I'll just be traffic. Right? I'm very fond of this insight. They are traffic. I am going somewhere. I'm going to the airport. They are the traffic that's in the way. Right? How many Show of hands, how many of you have consciously been traffic? Oh dear, what a shame, I'm clogging up the road for all these important people who are going significant places. And I'm just being traffic, getting in their way. You know, Sakaya Ditti is found in many places. Yeah. Self-view, personality view. If we cut through personality view, then there's that recognition that, hey, how come they're traffic and I'm not? You know. So, you know, you're not sort of saying the real me is this thing, and I would demand to be seen in this way. I demand to be seen as Buddhist monk, Theravada, this is what I am. I will be always seen as this by everybody in all circumstances, and if not, I'll get upset. So there. It's kind of foolishness, isn't it? You know, if we demand that or want to make that happen, then we just drive ourselves nuts and make ourselves miserable and lonely into the bargain. So just all of us live in a multiplicity of worlds, just so to let ourselves adapt to circumstances. Sometimes, you know, we're sick and need to be looked after. Sometimes we're doing the looking after. Sometimes we're the child, you know. And there's a friend of ours in England who, you know, she was in her 80s. Her mother was like 90. And then in her late 90s. And her mother still related to her as this sort of naughty little girl. You know. There she is, you know, she's 80. But to her mother, she's still a naughty little girl. Still can't behave properly. And Ajahn Taneer was talking about your Aunt Hetty, was it? Still straightening out her younger sister. Aunt Hetty was, what, 93? 90, and straightening out her younger sister at 80, in her 80s. Still can't fold the napkins properly. 83! 85, you know. You know, so sometimes we just have to be the kid sister, even if you are 83. You're the kid. Sometimes you have to be the boss. Sometimes you have to be the follower. And so that letting go of personality view is just, okay, if it's time to be the boss, I'll be the boss. If it's time to be the follower, I'll be the follower. Time to be the serious yogi, I'll be the serious yogi. If it's time to be the toilet cleaner, I'll be the toilet cleaner. Fine. It's not as though the real me is one thing and all the rest are pretense. It's seeing that the real me is a concept, it's a creation, it's a conception, it's conceived, it's determined into existence, it doesn't have a solid reality. There's awareness, there's the Dhamma. Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha are there. But the heart responding to different moments, different times, different roles, different situations. That adaptability is our refuge. That kind of mindfulness and attunement of the heart to time and place and situation. That's what we can rely on. And with the more that we do that, the more that we train the heart to adapt and to rely on that kind of flexibility, malleability, the less suffering gets created. And the more and more deeply that soaks into the system, the more that becomes just the whole way that we function. Then the less suffering is created. It's a very direct equation. And if there's, you know, no solidification of the I, me, my feeling, and there's no identification with the personality, with the body, there's perfect adaptability and no suffering. It's just, you know, mindfulness and wisdom, alert and awake. That's it. And life happens. Life comes and goes and does its thing. We meet, you know, the heart meets with praise and criticism, happiness, unhappiness, gain and loss. But it's like these are the worldly winds that Ajahn Taneer was talking about. They blow through that space, but there's nothing gained or lost, or nothing can be harmed or damaged, nothing that can be intruded upon or carried away. there's this tremendous easefulness and openness, contentment, joyfulness that is unshakable, indestructible. And this is our opportunity to cultivate the ways to establish that, to let that soak in, and then see how that works, to get to know that, and to see that we can trust that. And if we want to experience less suffering, to want to create less dukkha, we see directly for ourselves. You know, the more that this skill, this quality is cultivated, the less dukkha that there is experienced in the heart. But don't take my word for it. Take it and see how that works for yourselves.